Take your mic.
Thank you. Okay, good morning. We're going to go ahead and get started. Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Mr. Cleworth.
Here.
Mayor Pruz is absent today. Ms. Therrien?
Here.
Ms. Sprinkle?
Here.
Ms. Tidwell?
Here.
Mr. Marnie?
I'm here.
Mr. Ringstad?
Here.
I'd like to add to the agenda today, 4.5, I'm going to call it. This is just mutual aid agreement that was passed out. Just for introduction, there's not going to be any formal action on it right away. And Councilmember Therrien had asked for a moment of silence for the passage of Pope Francis. If we'd take a moment.
Thank you, Council.
First item is ordinance number 6283 as amended. Ordinance amending Fairbanks General Code by enacting section 10207 to require the vacant buildings be secured and registered, establishing fines for violations of these requirements. Introduced by Mayor Pruz, Councilmembers Sprinkle and Ringstad. First reading was about a year ago, May 19th, 2025. Public hearing has not been held. Who would like to tackle this one first? One of the sponsors? Okay.
Based on the number of vacant buildings we have downtown, I thought this would be a help to not only put them onto our radar for police and fire. They often are the magnet for unwanted behavior, but also to maybe encourage people who have been sitting on a vacant property, maybe don't live in town anymore, it's grandma's house, they're in Arizona. They think about maybe selling it, moving it along into use for a housing need that we know we have. So that this is a prod, a gentle prod to say, do something with your property or set it free. That's where I'm going with this piece. So that's what, John, you want to throw in?
Yeah, my thought, I like the idea of trying to help our folks know what's out there, if places are vacant. You know, we're starting to see too many of these squatters that land up in vacant houses and then they just trash them and or burn them up. And then we got to deal with the fire department. I like this more as Sue said, a prod to help people, help our people on that have to clean up the mess that's left behind and maybe help some of these property owners realize that this is a, maybe we need to pay attention. Because what I'm getting on some of our properties that there are owners are not in town and they're not really paying attention. So if this, that's better than just having them vacant and people squatting in them.
Mr. Marnie.
Well, you mentioned the keyword squatters, and I think, you know, Mr. Chard and I have had several conversations along that line to determine even if the state has a squatter law, and I don't believe so. So if we were going to work on that also or include that, this would be a good document to me to have some kind of language on squatters.
Yep. Sue, go ahead.
I'm intrigued. Does that mean at present, we don't have, Mr. Chard, we don't have anything that talks about what a squatter is, or is that something we need to define and then work with to make any teeth in this, or was that just an aside?
If it's the council member
Marnie is correct. There's not a lot on the books to help property owners with squatters. So if that's the intention of the council, we would have to beef up that section of this bill.
Jerry? I hadn't thought about from this perspective just yet, but I have I've had a couple of people comment to me about, gee, somebody gets in my building, you know how hard it is to get them out? And I don't know, quite frankly, I don't know what you legally can or can't do, but maybe we ought to find out. And at the same time, people are going to, you know, come to our police force and say, you know, help us get these guys out of our property. And if we've got nothing on the books, it's not helping them do it either. So I think that maybe we ought to take a look and see if we can address it.
Okay. Valerie?
Well, the ordinance does say that the property owner can let the police department trespass the people on there. I don't know if that's something that would satisfy you, Lonnie, but I know when we start getting into whether or not people are squatters, whether or not people are homeless, there's all those constitutional issues that might look into that. Maybe our attorney can help us with that, but I don't know that this is the vehicle to do that, especially if once they register, then they could trespass them. And then we got to deal with the DA's office, trying to make sure that these people face the consequences if they come back in. But.
Sue?
Squatter's laws. I'm just thinking outside of this ordinance. Tom, do we need to worry about running into state law in a situation if we were to do anything regarding squatters?
No. However, Councilmember Therrien is correct. The problem of squatting is where criminal law and civil law come together. On the criminal law side of the house, you can address things using trespass laws and things like that. On the civil side of the house, this is where you start to get into like evictions and things like that. I think that the civil side of the house gets a little sticky around squatters' rights, and because now we're talking about evictions, but we're not actually the property owner, things like that. Councilmember Therrien is correct that one of the strong benefits of this legislation that you're considering is giving FPD a procedure to trespass people off the property. That's a little difficult right now because the city needs the permission of the private property owner to be able to do that. We don't always have that. So that's the rub here.
It encourages. This would help them.
This certainly helps.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Other discussion? Ellery?
Mr. Chard, could we make it a requirement once they register that the police can go in and trespass people as opposed to may grant? Because what if we can't get a hold of the people and we need to trespass people off that property?
My understanding is that once a private property owner registered with the city, it would give blanket authority to FPD to be able to trespass people off of that private property. I'd have to take a look and consider a little bit more requirement. It'd be difficult if we're requiring people to register their vacant property, and then we are also requiring them to give us that authority. I think that's going to be where there's a little bit of a rub on that.
Jerry?
John?
I think I like where Tom's going. I don't want to necessarily you have to give us that authority, but I would guess most people would say, yeah, please, if they're in there, please send to get them out. But rather than use the club and say, do this, I mean, then they might just not register them. I'd rather have them registering so we know where our problem areas are.
Lonnie?
One more
sideline here. Can we discuss these annual registration fees?
Sure.
Some of those, I mean, $500 a year, pretty pricey.
Is it?
Well, I...
Property, a house.
Well, when you're used to not paying anything.
And that's our problem.
I can see where you're going, you know, that would force somebody to really think about, should I hold on to this piece of property or should I, you know, sell it? I mean, I see the incentive there, but...
John?
They're already paying property tax. Not like it's free property, they're still paying us property tax on it.
And garbage tag, or, you know, the garbage fee.
But we're already charging them $7 a year.
Anyway, just food for thought, I mean, this looks like it still needs some more revision.
Work on that language for the...
Maybe talk to the DA's department?
I can talk to Joe to see, you know, historically trespassing has not been, particularly trespassing individuals that are unhoused, has not been a high priority for the DA. I think that one of the things we'll have to make sure is that the private property owner secures the location, especially if it becomes a repeat problem. But I could certainly take a look at the language and try to work on it.
A few comments. I like the revisions that you folks have done in this. We're getting there. Just one typo. On the second page there, the property owner may grant. We get rid of one of the mays, maybe. a question on the front page, which is existing language. It says section 10207 down there in the bottom, vacant building definition. A vacant building is a structure designed for residential or commercial use that has not been lawfully used for residential or commercially purposes. What are we talking about there, lawfully used? I mean, they can use it for anything they want. They could use it for storage, residential, commercial. The word lawfully doesn't seem to fit. What do you think?
In our code?
Apparently it's in our code because it's not an addition. None of this is?
This is all new, right? The highlight part, the bold part, isn't that just the changes that you made?
Okay, you're right.
Made?
Add new section. Okay. I would recommend that change, that word be changed or taken out. Doesn't mean anything. Just lawfully.
Councilmember Cleworth, if I may, understand your question. I think it's astute to point that out. I think the intention there was if you have a residential building and there are squatters in the residential building occupying it.
I see, okay.
It wouldn't necessarily be a lawful use of that building. So I don't, that definitely needs some work though, that definition.
Okay. To the two sponsors, do you want to put this on Mondays for first reading and then change it after that, or do you want to bring it back to a work session? What would you prefer? Okay. Do you want to schedule this for the next work session then? Okay.
Yeah, this one's not coming back until May 19th, Mr. Cleworth, anyway.
Well, it would be, yeah.
Council meeting.
But I don't think they want it introduced Monday night, is what I...
Right, yeah, it's not coming until May 19th on the council agenda.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ellery?
If the sponsors approve, I would like to also co-sponsor.
No, they won't let you. Okay, we're going to move on to item number 3, ordinance 6285 as amended. Ordinance amending Fairbanks General Code 7436, Economic Development Property Tax Rebate, and enacting Section 7437, Tax Incentive for Property Development, Redevelop, or Renovation. This is coming back, well, this was before us last year in July. Well, we go back to Councilmember Sprinkle and Ringstad on this.
Did we mention yesterday? Okay, so I and John met with our mayor and the borough mayor. Mike was there as well, and we talked about dovetailing this ordinance to something that they would propose so that it would layer, complement, call it whatever you want, so that it will help maybe boost, move a needle of other builders and people who would like to take advantage of this. So I think that's a really great muscle to flex, and it's going to take a little moment or two. So they hope to have some meetings within their own organization, be at the borough. And John, did we plan to meet again? Mike, no? Anyway, so this will probably show up. We might have to postpone for a meeting or two, but we want to make sure that whatever we do together will be helpful. And things like waiving tipping fees were mentioned. A sunset date would be helpful. So anyway, this is starting to get some legs, and I think that's really exciting.
Jerry, it's calling up on that. Grier was pretty enthused by this. I think he wants to do something too on their level, and the thought would try and do parallel and probably have both us and the assembly working this June area timeframe. We're not, I'm not completely 100% tied to any language. We're trying to make something. I thought about this after our meeting yesterday, and I'd like to see something going in downtown, and what do you do about that? And I realized long ago, back in 71, I think, the first time I went to Cleveland, and it was an old industrial city that had nothing going on. It was kind of a dreary place. I went back there, and I wasn't there again until 89, and it was a completely different city. And I started talking to some of the locals there and finding out, what's the deal here? 13 of the 100 largest businesses in the United States had their corporate headquarters in Cleveland. I thought that could not have happened by accident. I mean, why would our largest businesses move to Cleveland? They decided they were going to change the town and not let it die, and they're going to go do something. And I've thought about that, and I think, okay, I'm not looking for that, but I don't want the downtown and our Fairbanks community to just wither away and say we did nothing about it. So my hope is that we can invite people in. Sue has been doing most of the work, quite frankly, on this. And I think, she's been gone to meeting with other people. We're talking to some of our builders, some of our lenders, trying to figure out what will work, what will give people something that'll make a difference to say, yes, I've been thinking about it. Maybe this will make me say, yes, this is a better deal for us. Clearly, we need new housing. We need additional housing. We need to fix up some of our old housing before it comes off the market. Likewise, I think that we need to think about how do we get incentive to have businesses locate in Fairbanks and in downtown Fairbanks. So I think I felt really good about our discussion yesterday over at the borough. Their enthusiasm that our two groups work together. So if people, I was kind of hoping to get thoughts and input, see what all the group here thinks and how we can make this a better package that will actually make a difference and give people the incentive to invest here.
Sue?
I just want to throw out that John and I have been step-by-step working this through, but I had a super team with Mike and Margarita in helping look at the numbers, make sure this would be a process that actually mattered, made sense, and hopefully it will instigate some change. So I just wanted to acknowledge the other help that I've had. Thank you.
Valerie?
Margarita, could you just explain how the rebate would work? I assume a rebate means that we'd actually give them money, or is it just an offset on property taxes? If you could just clear that up for me.
Yes. You are correct, Ms. Therian. They would receive funds. The way the program would work is they would work with the building department. They will file paperwork that proves that they have fulfilled this section of the code, and then we will issue a check for the amount that of that building, the assessed value for what they have improved, and we would rebate them for that portion.
And so they would get if they did $1 million, they would get a check every year?
Yes,
for five years,
correct.
And would it be based on the old valuation or the new valuation?
It would be based on the assessed value of that year, because they will actually pay the property taxes. Everything is assessed through the borough. So okay. When the borough does the assessment, as the building improves, they will add that value to their tax payment, and they would make that payment through the borough. We would receive it, and then we in turn will reimburse it.
I understand it,
the first part of rebate has something to do with it, with our tax cap. So if we just say you don't do the taxes, then it affects the tax cap. This way, it's designed to not affect the tax cap, the way it works now. And the rebate would be for the increased value, not the total value. You're going to pay on what you've already got. You know, if you increase and you put another $100,000 into the building, then and the value goes up $100,000, then that's what the rebate is, the taxes on the increased value. Right? Did I get that right?
That is correct. Thank you for clarifying.
Crystal.
I just wonder, John mentioned that, Sue, you've been meeting with, like, some builders and stuff. Have you had any input from the builders on this, that it would actually make a difference?
The only one I've really heard from yet is Seth Church, and he did make some suggestions. I think we all got that email. Okay. Did we not? Anyway, I'm just going to follow up with a couple more that I know personally, just to lock it down. I mean, I can't beg them for input, so right. I'm doing my best.
And then one other thing that I just wanted to mention, I remember last time when the borough was working on theirs, part of the comments that we had heard at the Planning Commission from the builders was the process with the borough, the paperwork side of things was so
onerous,
difficult for them to get through. So hopefully when they're working on theirs, that's something that they remember, just to make the whole process a little easier.
And I think that'll be the trick too. If the borough wants to dovetail or mimic, I don't know what they'll do, but we're using permit paperwork and something that is normally already in the process. So it's not to add another layer of anything to this. I think that's pretty easy on our end. So we'll see.
The borough doesn't have building codes, so they get a different system, but That was one of the things I was trying to avoid, because everybody said this just wasn't worth it,
right,
for what the borough did, and I don't want to do something that nobody wants to use. So that's, I think she's got a couple more names of people to builders. If anybody knows builders, ask them what they think, and let's find something that works for them and
make it worth their while.
Likewise, the lenders and the people that are going to do it, just I want something that they're going to want to use, and if not, I think we're wasting our time. So.
Lonnie.
Well, you know, I got to thinking, I think it was in the late 90s, probably the early 2000s, when all of a sudden we had Weeks Estates being built, Raven's Landing.
So where did those, where did that group, I know Raven's Landing's separate than the Weeks Field project, but how did that roll into town? Do you recall how, who were the investors on that? Where did that money come from?
Well, the city actually owns the property. Yeah. And under the housing project that replaced Fairview Manor also. And we worked with Raven Landing. They originally wanted the site for our snow dump over by the curling club. And that was a bullet we dodged, barely. Because if we lost that, we would have a long haul rate for the downtown, which Public Works was never very much against. But we worked with them to move them over to where they are now, which is a better location for them anyway. But I forget the tax.
We gave them 10 years or something.
Yeah, there was some kind of a break there on that.
But what group? I mean, where did that money go? Did it leave town or, you know, was it local guy investors or you recall? I don't recall.
It didn't leave town, I don't think. I don't recall.
Let me think. Raven Landing is the local nonprofit. On the other end of that block, I don't know if that's a low-income housing.
Well, it was sold as middle-income.
It's owned by a... We had this discussion, the Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Service that David and I sit on about a year and a half ago. The guy that owns it, I think, is somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, and he's been trying to sell it, but he wants way too much money for it. But I don't think he was the original owner.
Okay.
But he is. I think he's not from here.
So it's just what was just a natural development?
Yeah, and I don't know how he got to the point of doing that or whoever actually built it.
Pat Smith, we had a property coordinator who put that whole package together. And
yeah.
So we have, I apologize, ma'am, I just don't remember all the technicalities there.
Well,
that
let
was
me expect you to remember everything. You're laborious. The institutional memory here.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, if the money's there, why aren't, you know, we need people like that to step up again.
Mm-hmm. Wait. Yeah. You know.
Just a question, Jerry. I think you brought this up the other day about looking at the city properties and potentially some subdivision lots over there by Birch Hill.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, it's a piece of property that we have that we take some of these things and put them together and say, maybe we get an investor or a builder that wants to go build. I don't know how many lots we've got over there, but more than what, you know. Like you say, you had a property, somebody focusing on the property that kind of help put it together. What to think about that.
No, we're scheduling. Are they going to be at a work session then with us?
I don't know what else to do with that one, sir. I mean, it's our snow dump.
There is more property there than the snow dump unless we've expanded it. The only reason I brought it up is I want to get a better handle of it because for a while we talked about subdividing and selling off lots. We may not be there anymore. I just don't know. That's why I'd like to have a work session on it.
That email that I sent you, sir, with the that had all the pictures and it had the like all the not only the snow dump but all the infrastructure that's underneath it. I mean, we may be able to squeeze out a lot or something out of that, but it would be I don't know. I think it would be a mistake to do it, but we'll get it. And I think it's scheduled for May. It was one of the work sessions in May. I remember Bob sent the email.
Okay, it's. I just think it's good to get us up to date, that's all.
Yeah, yeah.
Valerie.
You're asking that this rebuy program sunset in December, which is about 6 months away. Would you consider changing it to December of 26? I just think it's a... By the time we pass it and the public learns, yeah. So I would maybe suggest that. And Marguerite, I'm still confused. So let's say a builder goes ahead and spends $1 million in 26. The borough assessment comes out in 26. Would they receive the rebate in 26 for 5 years?
They will receive a rebate based on their assessed value for right. that increase in property. So the mill levy is levied in July.
Okay.
The council approves it in July. The property owner pays it in November, or they could pay it at earlier. So they pay that assessed value. So that owner or builder will not see the funds until 27.
That's what I was thinking. Okay. And we would also have to rely on the borough assessing department to get that reassessed, correct? Or would the builder tell us what he thinks the property is worth then? I'm just a little worried about the timing.
We talked about that a little bit yesterday.
Oh.
And most of the bankers, the lenders, will require an as-built appraisal. What's it going to be worth at the other end before they lend money on it? And that's part of why you want some of the finance people in here too. But they're going to, you should have something that said, okay, here it is. Here's the assessed value, and the new appraisal as built will look like this. But I think Margarita's right that, particularly with our construction seasons, you're probably going to be a lag time of a year. I don't expect them to have their, if they get finished building at Thanksgiving time, I don't think they're going to have it done before the end of the year. So there might be a lag time. We should ask that, ourselves, we put a sunset date on there. I don't know if you want it 1 year or 5 years or what you want, but we ought to discuss it.
Just the timing issues you might want to look at, but when I was on the council before, I tried to do this, so I'd like to co-sponsor. We were trying to do a, not a rebate, but actually just reduce their property taxes. I like the idea of not losing the value in the tax cap, so good job.
This is next scheduled to come up when?
This one will be back on May 12th.
Okay. Anything else on that? We'll move on then. Ordinance number 6313, an ordinance amending Fairbanks General Code to include paid parental leave eligibility for employees who have given birth. Okay, Mike, we're going to turn this one over to you.
This one is one that, hats off to Jake and Jessica for finding this one. So we have medical maternity leave, which is for folks that are, having a baby and they have a complicated pregnancy or delivery and they have some sort of disability related from that. And there's a legal definition of what that entails. And then we have paid parental leave, which is intended for, like the dads, the spouses, like the people that didn't actually have the baby. So the thing that occasionally we run into is somebody will have a baby, not meet the medical definition, so they can't get the MMLA, and they can't get the PPL because they're, the person that actually gave birth. So we just want to fix that. The past practice has always been to give them the 2 weeks if they don't qualify for the MML. So we're just trying to fix it. It's already written that they can't double dip. When you read through the entire section, it looks like as if it was intended for for the mother to be able to get the PPL if she didn't qualify for the MML. But I think we did, in the process of rolling it out, it just was overlooked, and Jake and Jessica pointed it out, and we figured it'd be an easy fix for that problem.
But you only give them 2 weeks?
That's it.
I'm hearing you right that basically we're doing this anyway, but we need to get it right so it's.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of been our policy.
Right, and this we've had this for a few years, so yeah.
Yeah, Sue?
What if somebody adopted? They adopt a baby.
It's all in there.
It's in there.
Yeah.
I don't see it.
The next page.
Backside?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a much larger section of code. It's only the one little spot that needs to be fixed. The rest of it's fine.
Okay,
Lonnie.
So was this the ordinance, I think I was the sponsor on it, where we actually created paternity leave? The city didn't have anything back then.
Yeah.
We had maternity, but didn't have paternity. And then we looked at the lengths of time. So this was included in that ordinance?
Right, back in 2021 is when it was originally created. And I really think it was just an oversight. You know, rolling out a big section of code, and it was just, it looks as if it was intended for the mother to be able to get one or the other. And the way it reads right now, she can only get medical maternity leave, and she can only get it if she has a disability associated with the pregnancy.
Danny, would you do me a favor? Could you create or find a copy of that original ordinance? Give it to us. Thank you.
Anything else on that? Okay, well, thank you for letting me add 4.5. briefly, what this is when we had our discussions on the ordinance that was passed originally on ambulance services that we spent a lot of time on, we talked about mutual aid agreements, and I had asked the fire chief to get us a copy of the mutual aid agreements that we had with the folks in the borough, the different service areas, and he found out or discovered there is no such animal. And as long as I've been around here, we always assumed that there was a document of some sort. Now, the borough does have agreements with each of their service areas. It's a rather complex document and, you know, demands them to follow state regulations in regards to those things like we have looked at. And the chief looked at it and I looked at it, and we both came to the same agreement. They're very cumbersome, long and lengthy. So we talked about having a mutual aid agreement inside the city here that was very short and explicit. The whole idea here is that let's say we have a perfect storm where all our ambulances are involved and we get a serious call, it would be nice, the more the merrier, from the sources that we can draw from. So if you have an ambulance company like LifeMed or Guardian or somebody that wants to participate in it, they can be put on the call list by signing this document with us in the city, and we can utilize them if we're totally tapped out and give them a call. And this would be for even the most important, like heart attack and things like that. Right now, and I'm going to have the chief come up and he can expand upon this, but right now, if a call comes in, then dispatch has to know which agencies in the borough that they can call or rely on, or what they do want to do or don't want to do, and it's kind of cumbersome. This would give us a resource if we have companies that sign up that we don't already have. But go ahead, chief.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kleeworth. So as Mr. Kleeworth noted, during our research for the ground ambulance ordinance, we found that there were no mutual aid agreements in the borough. Through the research of that, it seems like that throughout the years there were attempts at that, and it just kind of sat on the table and then eventually fell off the table and never actually got done. So what we currently have is a mixed bag of responses that some agencies will come to and some will not. Without a mutual aid agreement actually in writing, that sending agency has the right to deny that call, right? They can just say, sorry, we're not coming, good luck. There is a gentleman's handshake agreement that they will come to certain calls within the city limits, echo level calls, cardiac arrest, certain Delta level calls that are, you know, the next most serious, and then everyone's agreed to go to stroke calls, even though those are usually classified in the Charlie response code level. So what it does is that it still creates a spot where there are calls that could be stacked inside of the city, which the third ambulance has helped tremendously with that. But there are still times when, as you know, if you sit in town, all three ambulances will be buzzing by at any one time. So this gives us an ability to get different partners in the community to agree to this agreement. Yep, that sounded right. And if they choose to participate, then they would be able to be put on basically the mutual aid list for the city. And if all three ambulances are out and the requirements that are met inside of that document are there, so it's a Delta level chest pain call, which is what Mr. Kleeworth was relating to, probably to a heart attack call, then those mutual aid units have pre-agreed to come into the city and run that call for us. The fire side of the house is much cleaner. There's auto aid agreements in the borough. There's mutual aid. Like, all of that stuff works. And for many different reasons that have probably got us to today, the EMS agreements just never got signed. So this is an attempt to try to fix that. There's no guarantees. We can't force the pen on the paper. But I think Mr. Clearworth was correct that there is a gap in our signed documents between us and other agencies. And I think this is a simplified approach to fixing that without getting into a 45-page contract document that other agencies are using.
Yeah, Sue.
So if we're asking others outside the city to sign this, do we do the same for them? Is there some sort of paperwork we need to sign?
So the city has always went to all mutual aid requests in the past, so it would not be an issue for us if they requested one back for us to do the same. Currently, the city of Fairbanks will go to any request for mutual aid regardless of the call type. So it's only been the aid coming into the city, not the aid going out of the city.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea to try.
If there's no objections to it, we can have this put in a resolution form and come back. Would it be okay if you see that by Monday?
Sure. And when you say resolution, saying that we will create this, or is that a resolution that is this?
That offers this, essentially.
Offer.
Okay, does that work? Okay. Thank you.
And everybody wants to be the co-sponsors.
Yeah. Okay, I thank the chief and Tom for working on this for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome. Target-based budgeting, my favorite subject again. Number five, Margarita.
I'm going to start off with Mike. He's just going to give you an overview. You should have a document that just kind of summarizes target-based budgeting. He's going to start with that, and then I will address the yellow page that I turned out.
Yeah. Well, thank you for hearing about this and for, you know, being open to the idea. Margarita and I recently, I think it was just last week, went to a class that was great. It was about target-based budgeting and the benefits, the challenges. You know, it is a little bit of a change in how we do business, but I think it's such a needed change that I do think it'd be a great addition to what we do. So basically, how it works is it starts off kind of the same as we would with a regular budget. Is Margarita will figure out the revenue estimate for the upcoming year, and then. And then the next part is we start to figure out the what it costs to do our core services for the city, and that will depend somewhat on the revenue, of course. We can't spend more than what we have, but what we'll do is we'll go through, Margarita and I, just like we do every year, we'll go through every single line item on the budget, go through every single account we have, go through every single purchase that has been made, which takes an enormous, crazy amount of time to do it. We'll go through all that, but then we get with the mayor, and we're like, hey, this is the leanest core service package that we can do, and keep the service levels the way they are without canceling anything. I know that there was a pitch recently to get rid of garbage services. To keep what we currently have. This is what it would cost. So we'll take that to the mayor. The mayor will then bring that to y'all, saying, hey, this is what we can do. The services is, this is how, the base amount for each department, basically. And we will all go through that in August and September, and then way before the normal time of doing budget. And then when the actual budget stuff comes in, then we will only be, that will be set. Yeah. I've heard in this room many, many times that you want department heads to be in charge of their department, and this, you are giving them that set amount. Like, here's the core amount that you need to do your base services with. So they will take that funds, and they will allocate it as they need. One of the things that we've seen in here many times is that we'll have you know, a 5-10 minute debate over $1,000 or $2,000. But then, you know, like things that are hundreds of thousands of dollars just go through without a thing. So what this does, and the weird thing with that too is already the way the code is written, like when we take, you know, $1,000 out of one account from a department, they can still move the funds on their own. Like they don't need to come back to move the funds around to fix whatever it was that we'd adjusted. So what this does is it lets them have control over their core services, but then everything else comes to you as what's called a decision package. So with the decision package, it'll be like anything extra, anything new. If there's something that we cut from the core services, then they would have to come to you with that and say, hey, you know, I really need this for, you know, this amount for whatever it is. And then rather than making the decisions on the fly like we do right now, all those decisions will be made at the end. So they'll have a decision each. You'll still meet with every department just like normal. They'll have their list of decision packages for you. But you won't make a ruling right then. You'll wait to the very end. Then we'll bring all the department heads back in again for this last final one. And then during that time, we will have we've already created a spreadsheet so you can see in real time what that's doing to your budget. So you'll have your reserve on one side. You'll have all the unapproved decision packages, and then as you slide them over to the other side to where they're approved, then you will see in real time what that's doing to your budget. That way you're not just making decisions, you know, like say Public Works comes in first and, you know, you spend a bunch of money there. Then the last is, I don't know, finance. And, you know, maybe finance had something that you really wanted, but you already spent your money. This is like letting you really have that ability to see the big picture before you're making any decisions. And the big benefits that the other places that have done this have seen is that it really promotes collaboration between departments. Some of the folks that we were listening to in the webinar, they were, you know, really talking about that, how that meeting of all the department heads where they're going through this is a great collaborative time. And then the other thing is it eliminates all the, they call them games, you know, all the like padding your budgets and all that stuff. And even in here, I mean, there's, you know, games that, you know, happen in here too, but it eliminates that on both sides so that both sides are really coming with the best budget that they can for the citizens. I hope that it was a really long, complicated subject. I hope that's brief enough.
I like it.
Yeah.
Valerie?
Mike, would it reduce the need for amended budgets to come before us almost four times a year?
I would hope so. I mean, some of that stuff is, I mean, it's still going to happen. You're still going to have emergencies that happen, you know, like, you know, from time to time, there's going to be stuff that is just an emergency. But our goal has been for the last several years to get down to just two budget amendments a year. One you have to do. I mean, the first one is like you don't have a choice in that. You have to do that one. And then one other one throughout the year. It's what we've been trying to do for the last few years.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else?
Okay, if you have your yellow sheet before you, this is a proposed schedule. And as Mike mentioned, the difference, when we do our traditional budget, we always start with revenue. But we usually don't address the revenue side until we're really in the budgeting process. But with target-based budgeting, we do the forecast of the revenue first, and then we start working on those required costs that we have. Such would be what we call your base budgeting side of it. So in August, we would determine what our revenue forecast would be. The second part of it would be what our current operating budget looks like. And basically, we would start with what has been authorized for 2020. In this case, what was authorized in 2025 with adjustments for our current authorized staffing for CPI based on the collective bargaining agreement. And that's kind of the base budget. And then in September, after we after we have that part in place, we work with the mayor in August to determine what that base budget is. And then in September, we bring that base budget to the council. So you're actually looking at the revenue and the base budget way before you look at the full process in November as typical. Then once we finish with the base budget, get that on board, then the department heads will get their budgets very similar to what they've had in past years. The only difference is they're giving a total for other costs. The payroll costs are set based on the CPI, based on the collective bargaining agreement. So the departments are looking at the other cost and distributing it by line item. So they get that part done in September to the mayor. The mayor in October meets with every department head as previously done. And the mayor will make, he may ask some questions regarding how they allocate it, their base budget based on their other cost, and he will take a look at that time of their supplemental request. So anything above that, take for example, if you flip over your page, you'll see a supplemental budget request. And basically any changes that the department wants to do as far as personnel, whether they're adding, deleting a position, whether they're asking for a merit pay, all of that is placed on this form, as well as any request for an increase in the base budget, as well as their capital budget. So they will file this paperwork for any changes. So basically, when you're looking at the budget, you're looking at what is the base of what we need to operate currently, and then this supplemental document is going to give you anything in addition. And so it puts your focus on what is new, on some of the new things. So then once that part is done in October, the mayor's going to look at the base, how they allocated it for other costs, as well as the supplemental, and make his recommendation. And you will get that as you do, and by October 31, it'll be published. And then you start the budgeting process in November with the individual departments looking at what they did with their base budget and getting a feel for all the supplemental items that they want to add into their budget. And then you do a meeting with all departments to make the decision on what you want to do with the supplemental. And that doesn't take away that you can do that during the first budget reading or the second budget reading, but that you go into that when you go before that first reading, you've had a consensus on what you want to do with the supplemental request. And then it goes before the final reading. An approval would be by December 15th. So the goal would have it for first reading by November 25th. So the process is very similar as before. The difference is that we know what, we have a feel of our revenue, and that doesn't mean that I will not adjust it, and because it's our earlier time period than usual, it doesn't mean we might adjust that revenue along the way, but that just means that we'll have more for supplemental requests versus, you know, we'll have our core programs taken care of, and we'll just have additional funds for the supplemental. And that just gives you a feel of the process of what it would be for target-based budgeting. It starts with the revenue. It identifies what's main and core, and then it shifts the focus on what the additional and supplemental requests are. So you're spending your efforts on that versus what you know that you need to operate or provide the service.
John.
Margarita, about what percent of our budget do you think will be in what is termed here the base budget?
So our goal is when we reviewed the budget in 2025 and we prepared it, we will use that more than likely as the base budget with any additions and personnel cost. And so that's the way we're going to start. Of course, it all depends on what we have revenue-wise.
So what we're doing this year will be effectively the base budget for next year.
Correct. And we're going to look at your beginning.
So at that point, beyond that, the only thing we're doing is changes, what we're going to do more of or less of.
Correct.
Which is...
Sue?
It seems to me this process is going to take a little of the, song and dance, the emotional plea of the person sitting there, because we'll have time to look at it and maybe know more about what they want or don't want. I think. Is that what I'm kind of getting from
this? Yes, it does. It does. It shifts the focus from what you need to operate on a daily basis to whether or not you want to bring in something. And what other communities have done with target-based budgeting, they've looked at the supplemental request, and the council may or may not say, we'll approve this, but only for 1 year, which means that the next year that doesn't automatically become a part of your core. That department would have to come back again with that supplemental request, whether or not, or the council can at that time say, this is something that we want to see continuously. Now this becomes a part of the base budget. So those are decisions that are made as you're looking at supplemental requests. Just because you approve it for 1 year doesn't mean that it is something that will continuously be in the budget. And the reason why we're looking at coming back with the base budget earlier, you'll notice that's in September, and that allocated amount, because there's the discussion of whether or not what we have determined to be core is indeed something that the council feels is a core, and whether or not it needs to be adjusted at that time. And it's something you may say, we want this that's in the budget presently now. We prefer for that to be set aside as a supplemental request and not as a part of the base budget.
Yeah, follow up.
The strategic planning that you have instituted in our budget book, there's no reason that shouldn't still continue, right?
Oh, no, that definitely will continue.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that we've had a lot of success with that.
Valerie?
Margarita, I know that the Finance Committee has been looking at new revenues. Will we have any new revenue suggestions by August?
Yes. In fact, I was going to mention that when they meet this Thursday, they are looking at a part of, that's their main, one of their main projects, is to continue that project.
Great.
One of the ideas is taxing attorneys. You know that, right?
I should be retired by now.
Question, Margarita. On the September 2025 segment here, the last one, the department heads submit budget and supplemental budget request by September 25th. That submission is going to the mayor, not the council.
That is correct. And it's usually in that timeline that department heads submit their budgets to the mayor. And then I compile, get things ready for him for review in October. So that stays the same. The schedule stays the same. The only difference is that the revenue forecast is earlier than usually prepared. And but that doesn't stop it from being adjusted. If it's adjusted up, then that's just more we have for a supplemental request or for the bottom line to address any emergencies through that year.
Lonnie.
Mike, is the AFL-CIO contract up this year?
Yes, we will start negotiating that this year. Yeah.
Towards the fall?
Yeah, at the end of the year. It's up. At the end of the year, it expires.
And IBEW's next year?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So AFL-CIO starts January 1. We were successfully, and IBEW would be an end date of what? Or starting date, I'm sorry.
They both expire in December. So AFL-CIO is December 31st of this year. IBEW is December 31st of next year. And the good thing with this target-based budgeting is rather than having to wait till November, December to actually finish up the negotiations, we'll have a good idea in September. What the council will have a good idea in September, October. What what amount you want me to work with.
Okay, anything else? We'll move on to, if I can find my sheet here. Finance Committee report. We're meeting this week, though, aren't we?
Yes. Yeah. The Finance Committee is scheduled to meet this Thursday. They will be reviewing the annual audit. They'll have an annual audit update. They'll talk about target-based budgeting, just get an update. They're looking at a facade improvement grant this week, this meeting, as well as looking at a multi-year IT subscription and how we can address those. They'll be reviewing the financial statements as of March 31, and then they'll continue their discussion on a revenue project, which is the mayor's task of increasing non-tax revenue by 10% over 3 years. And this, what they're starting out with is they're looking at our fees, and if our fees have been keeping up with the CPI, and they're looking at whether or not we're recouping the cost of some of our major revenue sources. Are they looking at the cost of what it takes the city for to generate some of the revenue that we're doing? And we'll continue our discussion on other items. They're looking at some of the suggestions have been like optimizing our auctions and how we can improve on that. So we'll continue the discussion this Thursday at 7 a.m. in the Meeks Conference Room.
Thank you. Brings us to council member comments. I'm not gonna go around the room. If anybody has a comment, just raise your hand. Oh, okay, start with Valerie here.
Yes, John and I had a very successful trip to Juneau. We went down Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I came back Thursday. I think John came back Friday. One of the things that I'm looking into with regard to the baby boxes is the ICWA issue as to whether or not there is some talk whether or not the child is an ICWA child or not. I've called OCS and I've got a contact in Juneau. It turns out to be Bruce Downs. And to find out how would they identify a child as being an Indian child under the Welfare Act, since the mother is going to be anonymous. So that's one of the things I'm working on and trying to get that to Health and Social Services Committee as soon as possible. And I'm sure John and I have lots to talk about, but we'll do it at the next meeting unless you got something else.
Yeah, a couple of kind of follow up. Yeah, I thought it was couple of really good days. The biggest objection we heard by one or two, apparently several people told us, one or two members thought that it needed to be regulated and inspected, and we assured them with our 40 whatever we have EMT and paramedics, they could probably inspect it, and they could probably do that over at the ER. We really didn't need to require federal or state inspections of this stuff. But that was the only real objection from a couple of members. Everybody seems to like the concept, but the one technical one, Valerie and her expertise from her profession had a pretty good discussion with them and how to deal that with some of the Native kids. We had a really good discussion, I thought, with Senator Stedman talking about our 22% and the legislation he introduced. And we were pretty straightforward on that discussion, and I think he appreciated that. He has no intention of trying to force that bill through this year or maybe ever. But he said he was mostly or is mostly focused on our the ARM board, which is the Alaska Retirement Management something. Anyway, they oversee and set the how much money does it we got to put into that retirement funds every year. And his concern is instead of this thing paying off like it was designed to do 15 or 20 years ago, the curve is now going back up and it's growing instead of shrinking. And in that, he says, and the Arm Board's not doing a thing about it. So when we asked him, he said, yeah, they received the message. They were in my office the next day.
Are they government?
Yeah.
I think there's five.
And but we had a real good discussion. He said, yes, he does, in fact, think that the municipality should have a seat at the table at that discussion. And we said we would be more than happy to get somebody to participate in that and set in and give municipal input and help where we could on that so that we plan to stay in the discussion. So he's working this administratively, trying to get the Arm Board to start being more realistic and come to the table, and because it's a big ticket item. And he says, you know, they come in with a recommendation, they put in a budget, and nobody even discusses how much it is. It's just, I don't know, what do you say? It's like $250 million a year. It just plops in there. And nobody even knows hardly what it does. So he's trying to change that. So good discussion. Not that we need to worry about where the future goes. We don't necessarily need to worry about that legislation passing anytime soon. Is that pretty accurate?
Yep. Just one other thing. Mike, could you send a letter to the sponsors of the baby box bill to say that we have a community paramedic and all our fire department personnel that could easily inspect the baby boxes without having to establish an employee of the state to look at those boxes? And I'll help you, but I told them that we would try to get a letter to the legislature as soon as possible, because they want to start putting a fiscal note on it. And, you know, how many firefighters, EMT, paramedics, and can go look at a box once every month if it was needed, you know?
Yeah, there's an annual $500.
Well, one of the
$500 a year, I think, maintenance fee or something from Safe Haven. Yeah, they.
Well, the part of the problem politically, I mean, they're looking at their budget and a lot of discussion about we're going to not do any fiscal notes, yeah. You know, or very, very few. So you hang a fiscal note on, it's going to kill your bill, quite likely. So we were suggesting, and we told them that we would send them a letter saying, you know, this inspection, them is still we can eat that cost. I mean, we told them we didn't see any need for the state to spend money on this program.
No, it should be.
I don't know why they're doing that. I
didn't see any area that anybody was opposed to the idea. So, but they're just throwing up barriers, and didn't make any sense. But we were.
We could go on forever, but we won't.
Well, did the two of you bring home any capital money?
Any what?
Capital money.
We didn't see any laying around. They all said that they're going to be bare bones budget. Matt doing
really disappointed.
Match, and that's about it.
Federal matches.
But they are going to special session.
Okay. Any other councilmember comments, Sue?
I'm not quite sure what I've gotten into, but I've been appointed to the Alaska Walkability Action Institute. So that's underway, and I'm just meeting people right now on statewide, but we also have a group here in Fairbanks, and I don't know what's going to come of it, but I'm intrigued. So it's about infrastructure and walking and accessibility, I think. So I'll let you know more.
Anyone else? Next regular meeting is Tuesday, work session, Tuesday, May 6th.
Councilmember Clayworth, can I make a comment on that real quick, May 6th?
Yes.
The David Hale from Hale & Associates will be joining us. The AMLJIA is dissolving, and a new insurance company is coming online. One of the things that we asked Hale & Associates to come talk with you about is any changes in the policy from past to looking ahead future. So I'll circulate something just so you all have a little bit of information leading into that meeting. But if anybody has any questions, just let me know. Thank you.
Why are they just...
they're joining. So the folks that insured the municipalities and the folks that insured the school districts have merged into one entity. That one entity is now the surviving entity July 1 going forward. And so our policies are all shifting. We're going to have a resolution to sign on to the new policy. And I really just wanted a work session to make sure everybody was up to speed on what was going on and what the changes were.
Okay. David Hill also still has all the policies for the city, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. We're adjourned.
Thank you, team.